This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's MEAT+THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Heritage Radio Network. For today's Cutting the Curd, I am interviewing Emily Nunn, author of The Comfort Food Diaries. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on a cheat show.
Oh, great, great. So I am totally curious, how did the idea for this begin? It's a very serious memoir with recipes, just for our listeners who haven't already read the book. How did it begin?
You know, I haven't talked about the book in a while, and I was thinking that was probably going to be one of your questions. And I describe in the book that that somebody on Facebook gave me the idea, and I forgot about it. And this is, I'm not even on Facebook anymore, but after I had a suicide in my family, and a breakup immediately after, and just my whole life imploded. And of course, when people still went on Facebook and, you know, divulged family secrets and that sort of thing, I went on and just dumped all of my emotions and just horrible. Mm-hmm. And then I drank a bottle of wine and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be unfriended by everybody. But instead, there was all this incredible warmth and advice that, you know, I didn't take, but one of the people said, you know, you should, I didn't have a home. I had no money. I didn't have a home anymore. I had just broken up with my fiance and my brother was dead and I was a mess. And people said, well, come travel around and eat with us and you can cook for us or we'll cook for you. And one person in particular, a woman I'd gone to school with, who I hadn't seen in 25 years, said you should write a book, and I forgot about it. And then after I went through hell again, I picked it up. So it was on Facebook.
Okay. Well, it starts out with some awful events, which you've already talked about. And then right away, it seems that you're writing about those times. Did you write it later, and it just seems like you're writing about those times?
I'm not sure what you mean. You mean in the media?
In the beginning, yes, you were on Facebook, but were you writing the whole story right away, or did you look back and write it?
I started writing the proposal for the book about 2 months after I got out of the hospital.
Wow.
I was in the hospital. Well,
yes.
That's what I do. I was a writer and I was a cook and I had to do something. I was a complete mess. So, I didn't start writing about the things at the beginning of the book though until later, like maybe 6 months later, because it was really difficult for me to write about.
Yeah. But it feels very immediate. It feels very immediate in the book when you're writing about that stuff.
Well, I guess that's good.
Yeah, Yeah. Now,
and it's funny now, I try to forget it, but back then I couldn't forget it at all. So it probably seems like it was happening, you know.
What year did all that stuff happen?
It was a long time ago. And, you know, I'm 58 now. And one of the things that I think is always interesting about the book is that people thought it was chick lit because, you know, the title, that subhead, you know, the perfect dish to mend a broken heart.
Mm-hmm.
I was 50 when this happened. My brother and I shared
tell.
A...
I couldn't tell how old you were in the book or now. Because, you sound younger than that.
Well, I'm very young at heart. I'm very immature. I think the big thing is I'm very emotionally immature.
Okay.
And so I think, you know, I'm not sure if my editor and I decided not to talk about my age a lot because... Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason that I was so devastated was that it was at this point in my life where, you know, I should have everything together. And instead, I lost everything in an instant.
Mm-hmm.
But I was 50. I was 50 when my brother died, or I was 49. And it just would turn 50 in just a few weeks. We shared a birthday. But I got the book contract and started writing in 2012. So he died at the end of 2010-11, and then my book was supposed to have come out in 2015, but I had a nightmare book, experience, so it ended up getting extended once, and then again, and switching editors, and it was a bad experience on top of a bad experience.
Oh, no. Okay. So just to tell the listeners, so your brother died, his name was Oliver, and you then had a very bad breakup, and then you were put yourself in the hospital in Chicago.
Yep, and then I went to Betty Ford.
And then you went to Betty Ford in California.
And this was all in a couple of months.
Yeah, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And then you sort of hit the road.
Right. I after Betty Ford, I had been living out in my sister's house in the desert, and she was kind of like, you know what, why don't you not come back here? She had a desert house, and I thought I would be there for a while, and it was sort of like I was this hot potato that everybody sort of handed off. I was, you know, broken and useless, and, you know, and when suicide happens in a family, it really, especially in a dysfunctional family like mine, it really kind of explodes whatever, you know, functional capabilities that family has, and I was a little bit of... I was a mess, but I also kind of got scapegoated. So I ended up living with my aunt and uncle in my hometown, Galax, Virginia, for 3 months. Whenever I mentioned that it was 3 months, my aunt says, it was four. It was 4 months.
That's Aunt Mariah?
Yeah.
And oh, I love her.
Experience. Yes, she's wonderful. I'm getting ready to see her soon. That was a great experience for me. I mean, a really great experience. And it kind of gave me the strength to pick up and really hit the road and go back in time in my life to college friends, people I hadn't seen in a long, long time, and a lot of other kinds of people in my life, people that I'd met through Facebook or through social media, which back then was kind of a weird thing to have friends from social media. And so they're in my book, and my favorite chef from Chicago. And, you know, it was when it started out, I had celebrities lined up and, you know, famous people who were like, sure, I'll be in your book. And then I wrote about them, and the editor said, you know what? We like your family and your friends and, you know, the smaller things here than we do the splashy things. And so it ended up being a very different book.
Okay.
Now, in a good way for me.
Yeah. Now, when did you realize how important comfort food would be in your recovery?
If you'll notice, the book doesn't really have comfort food recipes per se. That was the idea, the kind of thread that got me to move and to connect with people and not to, you know, turn into a total, you know, hermit. But it ended up not really being about, you know, the idea of what we think of mashed potatoes and, you know, roast chicken and rich kind of gloppy foods. It ended up really being what people made for me, or the things that I wanted to make for other people. And it was important for me to, it was important for me not to try to turn it into the kind of aspirational cooking that a lot of us do now, a lot of home cooks, where we, you know, talk about cooking out of the French Laundry cookbook, which I did. Mm-hmm. But I wanted it to really reflect, I hate this word, but, you know, more of an authentic experience of, of trying to put my life together and using food as a way of being able to say to people, I want to come into your life. I want to reconnect with you. It was, it was a device. And
I want to give you this. I want to give you this, and I want to eat with you, and I want to feed you, and I want you to feed me.
Right. And at that point in my life, I really wasn't capable
of much else.
Doing that. Yeah, and doing it in a natural way, that the way people grieve and come together. My family was kind of falling apart, and so I really had to, it made me stretch myself in a way that I wouldn't have.
Okay. Now, you had very impressive previous jobs. I mean, I'm a New Yorker reader, so you invented tables for two?
Well, that's what it says in my bio. I feel guilty about saying invented it. It had, I had an editor, Craig Seligman, who was the head of Goings On About Town, and he started it. And then he left, and I took over. So I kind of turned it into the weekly thing. And back when we were doing it, and I was assigning people to write them, they weren't signed. We just did them, and, you know, Talk of the Town wasn't signed back then. It was in the 90s. So it was a lot of fun. And I like to think that I, you know, gave Tables for Two its identity and turned it into a, you know, a full-time thing.
So it started, it wasn't every week?
No, it was once a month.
And was it always at the tail end of the, you know, going out section?
No, they've made it much bigger. It's it used to just be, if there are four columns of copy on a page, it was one, not even a full column.
Okay.
You know, a little emblem and then about four paragraphs.
So it was more in Talk of the Town.
And writing short is hard.
Yeah, Talk of the Town.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I read it religiously now. I mean, you
it's
always
really
want to see who fell into, you know, Tables for Two.
It was fun.
Yeah, yeah. And the New Yorker needed food.
It did. And I'm glad that they've expanded it a lot. There wasn't that much food writing in the 90s. I mean, the food coverage and the way we were doing it. I mean, my sort of direction to our writers was, we're not reviewing food because we're not food critics. We're writing up places that we like, and we're telling a story. And you just wouldn't have presumed to be a food critic, you know. And now it feels like, you know, everybody writes about restaurants and food, and which is fine, you know. Fine, it's just different.
Right. And you were also the theater critic?
No, it was not the theater critic. The theater critic was John Lahr, and the second theater critic was Nancy Franklin. I covered theater for Goings On About Town, so I just went all the time and did blurbs and kept the magazine abreast of what was going on in the theater world and performing arts. I was an editor at the New Yorker. I wasn't a writer.
But still a great gig.
It was a great gig. I mean, going to theater and restaurant all the time was a great gig.
Really? What more could you want?
It was wonderful, and I loved the people are wonderful, and it was a great job, and I loved the people that I worked with, and, I mean, it was heaven.
And then
I don't know anybody who's ever left and hated it.
Yeah. Now, then you went to the Chicago Tribune and became a restaurant critic.
I had they brought me there to write about food. They had their food critic, Phil Vitale, who's wonderful, and they wanted somebody to do kind of the things that Phil wasn't doing, the high-end places. They wanted someone to do the middle, and I only did that for about, I had a column called, I think, Table Hopping, and I only did that for a year, but my secret plan was that I went there to kind of throw myself into the fire of, you know, being a full-time reporter. So I talked them into switching me over to features. And so I was a features reporter for several years. And then when things started going south at the Tribune and they had that sort of bad period of bankruptcy, I thought, I think I better go back to food. And so I went to the good eating section where I wrote about cooking and developed recipes and worked with the test kitchen. So I did a lot at the Tribune. So, and that was fun.
So then trauma strikes over and over in your life. And let's take a break, a short break, and we'll be back to talk about the rest. Okay? This is Diane Stemple talking to Emily Nunn on Cutting the Curd.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello. Diane Stemple back on Cutting the Curd, talking to Emily Nunn. So, Emily, first you leave Chicago and you think your brother Michael and sister Elaine are going to step up and help you, right?
And they do, yeah.
Okay, good, 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 good. And they make you go to Betty Ford?
My sister told me that, I can't remember exactly how she put it, but she said, I don't know why the fact that I'd just been in a very rigorous program for 10 days didn't matter, but if I was going to stay in the desert house, I would have to go to Betty Ford. And I was like, okay, sure, fine. I mean, I was a mess. And Betty Ford is a great place. I highly recommend it. I'm like an ad for it. It works.
And did you sleep so there or did you do the day program?
I did the day program.
Oh, okay.
So I was living in my sister's fancy desert house and driving about 20 minutes into, I can't remember the name of the town it's in.
Okay.
Oh, Rancho Mirage, which cracks me up.
Okay, so then after that, you decide to try to reach out to others and learn to find, quote, the sweetness in life. That's from the book. And you embark on this major trip all over the South, mostly, visiting relatives and college friends. And you tell such nice, sweet stories about all those stops.
You know, it saved my life.
Yeah.
I mean,
I wanted pictures.
About old friends, you know?
I wanted pictures of the comforting bedrooms you visited. And
you know,
the food.
I had for a, The bedrooms were amazing. I mean, I took pictures of every bed I slept in, and for a while I was posting them on Facebook. And it was the title of the section was Beds I've Slept In Since 2011. And I took pictures of my bed. I took a cross-country train trip and, of course, slept in some pictures of the train bed and pictures of, you know, inns that I stayed in, people's homes, their, you know, one futon, just, and it was a lot of beds, and they're not all in the book.
Well, yes, you do move around a lot. I mean, I guess that's a consequence of not really having a home for those, that time. How long was it before you got to Charleston? Because you had your own apartment there.
The time I left Chicago, yeah, I did. And Charleston was great. It was a good stopping off point, but it never really felt like home. As much as I love it, I didn't. But it was a year between the time I left Chicago and the time I moved to Charleston. It was a year. I got my book contract, which, you know, that was, you know, they give you a quarter of your book contract money, and I moved to Charleston, and a full year where I honestly had no idea, you know, it was hard to sleep, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But I did start, you know, that's when the trip started, and that's when, you know, I knew that I had to focus and I had to have a project that was going to lead me away from just, I mean, sorrow.
Yeah. Now, you don't talk much about missing drinking in the book. Was that on purpose, or did you not miss it much?
I honestly didn't miss it much, and I have not been, I'm very open about, you know, being in recovery and the periods of my life when I have, you know, gone back to drinking, and being in my relationship was one of those periods. I'd been sober for 5 years before I, you know, got into my messy relationship, but, I didn't miss it. And I can't say, here's the thing about being in recovery. You don't miss it until you miss it. And then boom, I know plenty of people who have been sober for 25 years. I'm not one of those people. I've relapsed. It takes you by surprise, but I'm not one of those people who can't walk past a bar or thinks about it ever. I don't know. It's weird. I don't ever think about it. And everybody's different, of course. You know, some people miss it the way they miss a relationship.
Right. So you didn't decide to leave it out, in other words. You just weren't thinking about it.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think people, you're the second person who's asked me that in an interview. And it wasn't a conscious thing. In fact, I think my editor said, you know, you should mention at some point how you're doing. And there is a passage in there where I talk about my imperfection as a person in recovery and the reactions that you get when you tell people you've stopped drinking are often harsher than the reactions that you get when, you know, you,
you
put a lampshade
drinking
on your head at a party. Exactly. I mean, people, you know, because I don't know why American culture is so weighted toward having a problem and just continuing it and stopping it. I think that's changed a lot, though, in 20
now,
years.
The college friends, Portia, Pat, and Weiler, were those their names?
Portia Dot and Weiler.
Oh, right, Dot. Can you tell us what did they provide you, together and apart?
Well, aside from this feeling that, you know, I had just talked to them the day before, all three of them had aspects of their lives that could have stopped them the way mine did. They're all terrific people, and they've, but they've also faced the, I can't remember the name of that scale, but the death of a husband, a divorce, the death of a child, loss of a sibling, breakup. There's a scale, and all of them had had, most of the people that I are included in the book had had at least one of those things, and not that long ago. Portia has been sober for, I think, 14 years. Mm-hmm. And I, in the book, I talk about how her husband finally said, look, you either do this or, you know, mm-hmm. we can't keep going on. And my friend Weiler came out of the closet when she was well into her 30s, I think, mm-hmm. which is amazing in the mm-hmm. South that, mm-hmm. you know, you could, that's a long time. And yeah. Dot had been divorced. And so, oh, and Dot also had a brother who was a suicide, mm-hmm. but that was when we were much, much younger. And so mm-hmm. that was definitely something that, that was important in our relationship, right. being able to talk right. about what that does. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of grief. So,
yeah.
You know, Weiler talking to her about, you know, my brother, you know, coming out and how hard that is in the South and how hard it was when you're our age, our era, it's really different. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in our late mm-hmm. 50s and mm-hmm. coming out when you were in your 20s was still really, really hard, I think, back. And Weiler confirmed that for me. You mm-hmm. know, she said it was the hardest thing she'd ever done in her life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you write at one point, no one lives unscathed for long. That's another quote, which right. I think is really true. You know, the more you get to know people, you find out all their bad secrets.
Absolutely, and it takes away those, you know, the power of those secrets. I mean, the mm-hmm. things that people are mm-hmm. secretive about are sometimes inscrutable to me, but everything is relative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Aunt Mariah, I feel like I had aunts like that in West Virginia, where my father was from. I love her.
Now she's the best.
And I loved how, this is why I love your book. You talk about at the end of your visit with her, how her mother's invitation, Aunt Mariah's mm-hmm. mother's invitation to a wedding fell out of an old cookbook and you just gave it to her the night before you left.
Yep. It was the invitation. Her mother died when she was in her 20s. Her mother's cookbook, which I think had been her grandmother's cookbook, and it was her mother's wedding invitation.
Yeah.
I opened it up, and her mother's wedding invitation fell out of the book. And I went into the kitchen, and I said, oh, my God. And I remember she said, Emily, I love you. Except she said it in that accent, that Tidewater, Virginia accent. And she had forgotten that it was there.
Right.
And
right.
I was pulling out all of her books and going right. through all of her cookbooks and right. recipe boxes. So
that just seemed such a good, encapsulation of your connection with the relatives and how you were giving yeah. back to them while they were giving to you.
And that was something that I had to remind myself a lot because when, you know, I had to take a lot from people, which wasn't something that I was used to doing. I was incredibly mm-hmm. independent and stalwart and, you know, even relationships a little bit of a loner, like I can do it, don't help me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, you know, really one of the main things that I learned while writing this book. I was at dinner with friends the other night and a friend wanted to pay and I just said, okay, mm-hmm. she wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes people happy to buy you dinner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't go through that thing that women do where you say, oh, no, come on, let me, or I'll get the tip. I just said, great.
Now, another thing that was sweet is that your girlfriends all drove you out of town, like led you with their cars, I presume.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that you knew the way, which I
yeah.
presume
it makes me feel
you
like
didn't
crying.
Really need, but it seems mm-mm. so sweet to me that they
it's very Southern.
Yeah, that they felt they had to do that to make sure you yeah. were on your way.
Yeah, and it breaks my heart remembering it, you know, with the mm-hmm. arm out the car window, waving,
yeah,
pointing
yeah,
down that
yeah,
road.
Yeah. Now, I suppose we should talk a little bit about cheese because it is a cheese show. So,
yes.
pimento cheese.
I'm so glad you brought it up.
I've had
I'm
it.
I'm so glad you brought it up.
I've had it. I like it. I love it. But, you know, is it...
You don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't get it.
Well, it's a total Southern thing. And my oldest sister was married to a man from New York. She's uh-huh. her first marriage. And she used to get upset because her mother-in-law would say, Allison, make that wonderful cheese dip you make. And she would say, it's not a dip. It's a spread. As if it was the worst thing in the world to call pimento cheese a dip. But it's not a dip. It's a spread.
And no, I think I know that.
Yeah, it's, you know, you eat it on crackers or white toast or even rye toast if you want to. But it's, I guess we kind of, we've sort of turned it into a fetish in the South.
So, but that is the main cheese in the book.
It's the main cheese in the book, although, you know, I have the book in my hand. I do have a spoon bread that has Parm in it.
Okay, good.
And...
Good.
And I have adapted my spoon bread. I recently adapted that for Food 52 with cheddar and chives, which was really good.
Oh, good.
But, yeah, there's not
good.
A lot of cheese in here.
Yeah,
and, you know, I told you, I think that Meadow Creek Dairy is right near Galax, my hometown, and I've been there.
Oh, I love that.
But they do.
But I love their cheese.
Oh, my God, it's really good. But pimento cheese, here's the thing about pimento cheese.
Okay, what is
it? A little bit of mayonnaise, not a lot of mayonnaise. You don't want it to be wet. And
we talking about making it?
Yeah, a little bit of mayonnaise and lots of pepper. And you use some of the juice from the jar of pimentos. You always use a jar of pimentos. You don't want, you know, your own roasted pimentos.
Okay.
And lots and lots and lots of black pepper. And that's it. And then you let it sit at room temperature so that it kind of, you know, I don't know.
Wait, what's the cheese? What's the cheese?
It's cheddar, really sharp cheddar, and you can use and you can use satisfactory cheese. You don't want to use a really good cheese for pimento cheese.
Okay.
You want to use
rat cheese though.
No, you want it to be really sharp.
Okay.
I mean, you can use. I don't know if you've ever heard of the cougar cheese from I can't remember which.
Yes.
University. Have you ever had it? It's really good.
I have because I had a niece who went there. What is the name of the college? I can't remember.
I think it's not Washington. It's a Western university. Is it Washington State University?
Oh, I'm thinking of something else. There's another college in the South that has cheese. You might be right.
Dairy school.
Yeah.
And it's in a can, a big round can, and it's crumbly, and it has the crystals, and it's delicious.
Okay. I'm going to have
I'm
going to have to do research on that. So, what is your favorite cheese, and what's your favorite cheese recipe?
Oh, my favorite cheese. This is going to sound really wimpy, and you're not going to be impressed with me at all. But
I'm ready.
I love, and it's not a wimpy cheese, it's a great cheese, but it's a gateway cheese. And probably everybody says this, but the Cypress Grove fog with the layer
Humboldt
of ash.
Humboldt fog.
Yeah, fog is
that's
just
very respectable. That's very respectable.
It's respectable. It's not exciting because it's been around for a long time, but it really is the cheese that when I was working at the Chicago Tribune, it made me start keeping a cheese notebook. I got super into cheese for a while.
Now, have you had
I also
it
really
with
love
truffles?
Grayson.
Have you had it with truffles? Truffle Tremor is the Humboldt fog with truffles in it.
I prefer the original.
Okay.
I'm not a big truffle person.
Okay.
I love it, but I got kind of, you know, having been in New York in the 90s, I kind of got overexposed to it, and people were using truffle oil, which is disgusting.
Right.
So, I mean, at the same time, having real truffles and, you know, cream of asparagus soup is pretty great. But I'm kind of anti-truffle. And I also really love Grayson.
Grayson is totally respectable. Have they ever won Best in Show? They may have won second. Best in Show is from the American Cheese Society, and it's
which
the pinnacle of the cheese world.
It was in Chicago when I was there.
I was there.
We talked to each other. But Grayson... cookies for a while that I think they may have stopped making. I did a little, I did a visit there when they were probably a lot smaller, when, you know, there were cats walking around in the yard. And I think they were doing another washed rind and may have stopped. Could that be right?
I know they make a Mountaineer.
Mountaineer.
And Grayson. I don't quite have at the tip of my tongue a third
Appalachian
cheese.
Maybe?
Oh, yes. Yes. Is that washed rind?
I think that's the one they stopped doing. Okay. Yeah, okay. I think so. I think that might be the one they stopped doing. We're probably both wrong about that. But
okay.
I think they may have done three or four cheeses, and now I think they just do two.
Mm-hmm. I'll get back to you about that. Well, anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Now, wait. Oh, you didn't tell me your favorite cheese recipe.
Oh, you know what? Right now, I would have to say that my own spoon bread with cheddar and chives, which sounds like a side dish, but I have made that for people at dinner, and we end up eating the whole spoon bread with the green salad. So I think that is my, you know, it's sort of like a southern souffle. Have you ever had spoon bread? Well, this is,
I think
of it as southern, and I think of it as a souffle, and I'll send you the recipe.
It's kind of
glorious.
Okay. I was very tempted by many of your recipes because I liked that they're spread out. You know, so it's not an inundation of recipes. And I felt like they were going to be easy enough for me.
They are easy. They are easy. I mean, there are a couple that are time-consuming, but I didn't really want it to be a cookbook as much as I did a book about food you know, how it, I don't know, it's such a balm.
Yeah.
I just love cooking so much.
Well, and I can't wait to make some of the recipes. Anyway, so it's been very nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And please, everybody, read the Comfort Food Diaries. The tagline is, "My quest for the perfect dish to mend a broken heart."
Which I didn't find, by the way.
Okay. So excellent, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.